The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Public Radio International present Walter Cronkite in Memos to a New Millennium, a meditation for radio written and directed by Norman Corwin, with music composed and conducted by Elmer Bernstein.
The New Millennium.
Say it slowly. There is no hurry. It will be with us for the next 1,000 years. Our calendars are based on the birth of an infant in a manger 20 centuries ago. It was one of very few global covenants ever made without having to fight over it. An agreement to number our years from the impress of that nativity. Not everybody was satisfied with the arrangement, especially cultures that had much older calendars. But right now, this being the last day of the last month of the last year of the second millennium, you have only to put a simple question to every knowing civilization in the Atlas. Ask them what date they will print in their newspapers tomorrow.
January 1, 2000.
Even though the new millennium will have arrived on schedule and to nobody's surprise, it will be the biggest of all late-breaking news. A tick of the clock precisely at midnight. A special midnight. One out of 365,000 midnights. And its effect will be to deliver us from a set of 7 bloody teen centuries, 1300 through 1999. Toward that deliverance, a good many of us have been busy raking the leaves of history, anticipating the future, hoping that in the new era, the family of man will get along better than it has up to now. Plethora is the word for the downdrags of looking back, the ifs, maybes, and could-bes of looking ahead. All this and more going on as we speak. And on this last day, fireworks, blaring horns, banging drums, singing, dancing, clamors like the raucous caucusing of crows, jubilations unlike anything since Noah grounded the ark, unprecedented in scale if only because there are millions more of us present than ever before to see a new year in. Throngs in Times Square, Piccadilly Circus, Hong Kong, Sydney, Rio, Cape Town, toasts, hugs, kisses, torrents of excitement. All of it to honor a pivotal moment out of the foreverness we call eternity. A mere fragment of time, good old mysterious time. The igniter of the Big Bang from whose lingering fallout we all are incidents. We the people, most of us anyway, give credit to God for the special effects of creation, starting with time. But the measurement of time is our invention. It was we who came up with the calendar, the sundial, the hourglass, the clock, the pendulum, the metronome, the stopwatch, and also that chronic nag, the parking meter. They all deal with numbers, another human invention and a big one. Not only big, but they can be intensely personal, since all Americans, at least, are known by numerals as well as names.
And may I have the last 4 digits of your Social Security number, please?
Numbers. Street number. Telephone number. Registration number. License number. And then the day-to-day numbers we live by.
2 equinoxes, 4 seasons, 365 days delivered in 12 uneven months.
And the register of numbers raised to greatness by association.
The 4 horsemen.
The 7 plagues.
The 10 commandments.
And 12 disciples.
The 23rd Psalm.
No question about it. Numbers have character, have pedigrees and powers. They stand for events so momentous they need no further identification. You know the range.
The 7th day.
1492.
1620.
1776.
1861 to 1865.
1914 to 1918.
1939 to 1945.
2000.
So, according to our formulary, we now become creatures of Millennium 3. And the first thing on the agenda, after a good night's sleep, will be to go about living in that millennium, equipping it, shaping it, deciding what to do with it. Given this commission, we have incentive to ask questions and seek answers on all wavelengths, write legible prescriptions, set goals, draft memos for new morals. A fair start might be to ask a few people old enough to know what a millennium is, and who care about such matters, what they would wish for between now and Millennium 3.
First of all, peace. We've had enough wars, more than enough.
Environment. Clean the sky. Purify the waters. Save the earth to save ourselves.
I hate to think of people without homes, living inside cartons, you know, in all kinds of weather. Freezing cold, wind, rain. Couldn't we,
For starters, then, three sparse memos. Keep the peace, clean up our act by tidying the stage, and give shelter. Questions worth pausing for a reply. Let's deal with those memos, taking them in order.
As I said, enough fighting. War is hell, sheer hell. Maybe in the new millennium we might at last honor a proposition recommended long ago by Aristophanes. Make love, not war.
It slanders hell to compare it to war, because the hells of mythology and religion, although superheated and stocked with torments, are in their way discreet and proper. Only the wicked are punished. The guiltless receive better accommodations. But in war, innocence is never spared. Babies, nursing mothers, old men, Cub Scouts, nannies, washerwomen, scholars and gentlemen, the lame, the halt, the blind, all are expendable. When countries come to blows, the protocols of legitimized murder don't bother with distinctions. A missile does not stop to ask a bistro which way to the barracks. Blasted homes, fused glass from broken bottles, scalded milk, cremated populations.
But many think it's just human nature to fight wars. Therefore, when war is inevitable, why go to the trouble of trying to prevent it?
To believe peace impossible is the surest way to make it so. Those who scorn the peacekeepers, who call them do-gooders and bleeding hearts, need to be told that the bleeding heart seeks to prevent the bleeding head. As for making love, not war, no society in the world would reject that prospect if it were put to a vote, because love belongs everywhere. As device alone, what equals love? Each of us was ordained by an act of love. The census takers tell us that so and so many billions live here and there, and give us percentages of this and that. But no count is made of moist lips and caressing hands, of games played in the playgrounds of the senses, of rooms lighting up in the mansions of the body. Love looms like the Himalayas. The equator cannot girdle it. It's fair in the darks of Africa. It teems in oases and archipelagos. And yet, time and again, the yields of love are corralled, marshaled, armed, set against each other, and in progressively hideous ways, destroyed. Usually by despots, just a few, that's all it takes, a Caesar, a Napoleon, a Hitler, a Stalin. They and their jackals, old men mostly, their kidneys in decline, their speech a diplomatic parsley, dipped in the blood of the young.
His Excellency wishes to acknowledge receipt of your communication of the 4th and to assure you that his government has no intention of interfering with the integrity of your sovereign people.
I return bringing peace with honor.
Accept, sirs,
renewed assurances of high consideration.
The lingo is polite as varnish, sincere as the cables from casualty counters to next of kin.
We regret to inform you.
And after communiques are exchanged and respects transmitted like greetings on Mother's Day, war comes. Millennium 3, please learn, and learn fast, that the regimented years whisk us off fast enough, as do antagonisms of chance, want, hunger, crime, fire, flood, killing winds. Nature's own bedevilments, the virus, malevolent gene, the stumbling heart, take enough prisoners without gratuitous war. The new rank of peace is proudest of all earthly dignities. Perhaps in the new millennium, our sons and daughters can learn to enjoy that pride and to live by it.
The environment, the ways we're offending Mother Earth.
We've punched holes as big as a continent in the ozone layer. We've gorged ourselves on resources that can't be replaced. We've dumped toxins in landfills that are likely to leak. We've percolated greenhouse climates from the bad breath of engines and furnaces. And by doing all those things, we've cadged from our children's future the sufficiencies and protections that are rightfully theirs. It's not as though nobody had warned us. Half a century before the Wright brothers, Henry Thoreau wrote,
"Thank God man cannot as yet fly and lay waste the sky as well as the earth. Well, we're safe on that score for the present."
But the present sped away, and before long thousands of flying machines laid waste not only the sky, but cities beneath. And then much of what war did not do by way of insulting the earth, we ourselves accomplished by slow and steady measures, proof positive that whatever wisdom we may have come by has not increased nearly as much as the need for it. We claim to have drawn wisdom from the oldest archives, from Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, sages, prophets, philosophers, but none of the ancients could have foreseen the unreliability of their descendants, the actuality that we, who have divined some of the profoundest mysteries of creation, would also annihilate millions like ourselves in world-engulfing wars. How could we possibly expect Plato, Confucius, and other legendary wise men to have guessed we'd be such clumsy wardens of the trust mandated to us? After all, we were granted a special status.
Dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth on the earth.
But had we been assigned to destroy certain living things in our charge, we could not have been more proficient. Of the fish of the sea,
the cod is gone from the Grand Banks, overfished. The salmon is in full retreat. The sardine has all but disappeared from the eastern Pacific. The dolphin is trapped in fishing nets set for tuna and destroyed. The whale is in constant peril.
As to our dominion over the fowl of the air, early last century the naturalist Audubon reported having watched a flock of passenger pigeons pass in a stream that lasted 3 whole days.
Billions of this beautiful pink-tinted bird with dark gray feathers and a long tail. At times they were so thick they darkened the sun. It was magnificent.
Said in 1813, when their number was estimated at 9 billions. In 1914, the exact count was 1. A single passenger pigeon remained. The rest had been killed for their feathers, or for food, or for sport, or because they damage crops. The sole survivor, given the name of Martha, died in the Zoological Gardens of Cincinnati. As of last month, more than 40% of the world's arable soil, once held together by trees, grass, and underbrush, had in the name of progress and development been stripped, whereupon it dried out, crumbled, and was eventually washed to sea. So all in all, we have been careless caretakers of our ward. We have slashed forests, dirtied skies, drained wetlands, overgrazed pastures, stunted mountains, acidified rain, degraded rivers, turned cities into smudge pots, and driven once abundant species to the brink of extinction, or over it. It's a hell of a record. A few postscriptive memos, then, to Millennium 3. Item: be kind to trees. They give fruit, shade, and ornament, and, bounty of bounties, oxygen. Item: insist that every oil tanker and freighter plying waters anywhere be toilet trained. Item: assign to the vaunted ingenuity of science zero polluting fuels so that our skies may at last be clear of pestilences.
If you remember, sir, about the homeless living on the streets in cartons?
Oh, well, there are no rents or levies in cardboard housing. The only taxes are on health and dignity. Certain amenities are absent, such as walls and a roof, yet the floor is always firm, authentic sidewalk pavement. But no frills, no chairs, no bedding, because no bed, no clotheslines, because no clothes, no toilet, sink, no mailbox, no address.
Without an address, you can't even take a book out of the library. Did you know that?
Maybe a few newspapers, old ones, to roll up and stuff in chinks against hard weather. And pasteboard doesn't wear well. Whatever its color to begin with, it goes iron gray. It warps. When wet, it turns to mush. And decor is lacking. To be sure, there are inscriptions on cartons, just as on temples and public buildings. Only they're not carved in stone. They're printed.
This side up.
Handled carefully.
Made in Taiwan.
Refrigerate after opening.
The poor are always with us, and have long been, so we mustn't scold the departing millennium harshly on that score. The dispossessed may go unsheltered, but they're not unnoticed.
I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
If there's an ordinance against sleeping on a park bench or under an overpass, then it's my duty as a policeman to clear the area. It's the law.
They're an eyesore. They upset tenants in the condo. They're idlers and vagabonds staking out wherever they choose. This is a high-rent district, and their loitering has a bad effect on property values.
They say we don't want to work. Well, there was an ad in the paper offering 15 jobs. Over 800 of us stood in line hoping to be hired.
The assumption that the homeless are mostly no-gooders who avoid work is unfair to a class that can't reply through lawyers, lobbyists, or public relations counselors. By official count, the incidence of fraud among welfare recipients has never exceeded 0.4%, whereas the IRS estimates that 34% of private income nationally goes unreported.
Poverty is as old as hunger, but in a world where massive government buildings, supermarkets, sprawling theme parks, city-sized airports, and colossal stadiums rise overnight, where a star pitcher averages $5,000 for every ball he throws, where an executive fired after a few months on the job can take home $90 million in severance pay, where the cost of waging wars compares to the expense of health and housing as Mount Everest compares to a sand dune, it ill becomes the well-housed, well-warmed, and well-fed to carp about sidewalk space for the poor. Hence to the doers and mentors of Millennium 3, a modest suggestion. dismiss the crotchet that destitution is God's punishment for indolence and sin, and that the hungry are hungry by choice. Again, Scripture tells us,
the poor shall never cease out,
but adds a caution,
never mock them.
No jury is grand enough to indict or exonerate the late millennium. But since lessons of history cost high, and the cost keeps rising, the least we can do is to study them. Certain things we know already. There will be a long wait for a brave new world. The besotted old one will not just pack up and check out on the morning of January 1, 2000. Everything will carry over. Business as usual, good and bad times, quirks of policy, frettings of government, effusions of art, neuroses of the stock markets, mergers, marriages, divorces, yo-yo whimsies of fame. There will be heroes and abominations, paucities, generosities, atrocities, events so momentous they'll be identifiable by a word, or a bar of music, or a place name, the mere sound of which brings instant recognition.
Eden.
Let my people.
Gethsemane.
Be or not to be.
When in the course
I only regret that I have but one.
No little note, nor long remember.
Live in infamy.
It's one small step for man.
Buchenwald.
The good news, though sparse, is that there are among us dedicated volunteers, people of conscience, and we need them, because the rest of our lives will be spent within the compass of their concerns. They've resolved to do what most of us can't take time even to attempt, to heal old wounds and prevent new ones, to guide us through channels of change that one day may be our only escape from menaces inherited by the new millennium. For certain, our sons and daughters will be as unpredictable as we. The treasures, trash, obligations, and dilemmas left by us will belong to them. Nor does it take a seer to warn us that the future, like nature, makes no pledges. It's well and good to love nature when she's friendly, but don't count on her. And let's be cautious, too, about prognosticators. Take certain pronouncements by figures well known to us, starting with a president of the United States. Here is Rutherford B. Hayes in 1876 concerning the newly invented telephone.
An amazing invention, but who would ever want to use one of them?
Andrew Carnegie in 1900.
To kill a man in the near future will be considered as disgusting as we in this day consider it disgusting to eat one.
Thomas Edison in 1922 on the development of commercial radio.
The radio craze will die out in time.
Lee DeForest, inventor, in 1926.
While technically television may be feasible, commercially, I consider it an impossibility, a development of which we need waste little time dreaming.
Henry Ford in 1928.
People are becoming too intelligent ever to have another big war.
John Foster Dulles, not long before the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Only hysteria entertains the idea that Japan contemplates war on us.
Daryl Zanuck, head of 20th Century Fox Films in 1946.
Video won't be able to hold on to any market after 6 months. People will soon get tired of staring at a plywood box every night.
And reaching back, there was Nostradamus, famous for the accuracy of his prophecies. He made a prediction in the 16th century, which expired only a few days ago.
Between November 23rd and December 21st in the year 1999, the final battle between the forces of good and evil, the Battle of Armageddon, will take place.
Perhaps the only fully guaranteed prediction is that the sun will rise tomorrow and shine on all the calendars in the world that are exposed to its light. In the vast store of speculations on the new millennium, this program will amount to little more than a pebble on the face of a glacier. But having gone this far, it might be sluggardly not to put forward this last notion, that anything mankind has made or committed can be changed, especially our mistakes. No doubt it would be heavy sledding to implement our wistful memos, but isn't war heavy sledding? And responding to natural disasters, and building a space station, and finding cures for AIDS and cancer. Need it take a breed of giants to refine priorities, sanitize values, cleanse the house we live in, humanize the body politic? Are such ends beyond the reach of the same species that writes poems and symphonies, gives us Shakespeare, Leonardo, Beethoven, Lincoln, Einstein, dictates to the atom, tames tigers and rivers, bores tunnels under the sea? From the very beginning, when our ancestors breathed through gills, hasn't every waggle, every thrust, every inch plodded, every proliferating cell in our pedigrees, been in response to challenge? What are the odds that we're not through growing? What are the odds that maybe we're just getting started? You and your children have a safe and decent millennium.
You've been listening to Memos to a New Millennium, written and directed by Norman Corwin and narrated by Walter Cronkite, with music composed and conducted by Elmer Bernstein. The program was produced by Mary Beth Kirshner and mixed by Warren Dewey. The cast included Richard Dysart, Alice Backus, Melanie Chartoff, Steve Franken, Louis Nye, Orson Osman, Mala Powers, Phil Proctor, and Elliot Reed. Memos to a New Millennium was made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the Amundsen Foundation, Norma Ring, and the InterRep Radio Store, selling today, innovating for tomorrow. A script of this program is available at 1-800-411-MIND. That's 1-800-411-MIND.